You have already heard enough to bless you on this beautiful morning. I would like to mention that if you are a visitor, or have been a visitor several times, we will be receiving another group of new members into this church on the 17th, and I would be delighted to talk with any of you here at my home, at your home, or down by the pond with the blackbirds singing, anytime you like. So simply let me know. We're eager to have you as a part of this wonderful place. When you start looking at what people have said about children, you find a lot of ambivalence. Probably because children can bring more joy and more misery sometimes than just about anything else in life. Our feelings run the gamut, all the way from Herbert Hoover's solemn statement that children are our most valuable natural resource, to George Bernard Shaw's satirical quip, "I must have been an insufferable child. Most children are." Some of this same ambivalence is reflected in the New Testament, where two men in the first century had things to say about the mind of a child. The first one said, "Unless you change your whole outlook and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." A few years later, the other man wrote, "When I was a child, my speech, my outlook, and my thoughts were all childish. When I grew up, I had finished with childish things." So one says to his disciples, "Be like kids." And the other says to his parishioners, "Grow up." You probably recognize both men. The first is Jesus, who says that if we hope to enter the kingdom of right relationships, we have to recapture some of the qualities of childhood. The second is the Apostle Paul, who at the end of that great lyrical sermon on love we've been talking about for weeks, rejoices that he is grown up and no longer like a child. They aren't really at odds, Jesus and Paul. They're simply looking at different qualities in children. The difference we have in mind when we compliment one grown-up for being childlike and rebuke another one for being childish. When Jesus says to adults that unless they become like children, they have no place in his kingdom, he is asking them to be curious and open, unpretentious, full of trust, eager to love, all the attitudes we cherish in children. But Paul is looking for a moment at the other side of childhood, the limited knowledge, the preoccupation with oneself, the temper tantrums when we don't get our own way, all those undesirable things we mean when we use the word childish. Paul says that he has put all that aside. But I wonder, given his volatile temper, I would guess that once in a while he must have slammed a saucer on the floor and kicked a broken chariot wheel, acting, as our Dr. William Menninger used to put it, like an imbecile. But at least he knew what it was to be a grown-up, and that's what he wanted. So despite what looks at first like a contradiction, Jesus and Paul are in total agreement. Both of them know that if the silliest thing in the world is to be a grown-up who acts childish, the loveliest thing in the world is to be a grown-up who is childlike in all the ways that endear children to us. Agape love, the kind of thing Paul is writing about in this chapter we have so carefully analyzed, has no place for childishness. It's built on the notion that people should be grown up. Paul would have no patience with the thin, watered-down stuff that is a staple of too many Sunday schools and too many pulpits. He would have agreed with St. Augustine, who put these words in the mouth of Jesus, "I am the food of the full grown. Become an adult, and thou shalt feed on me." I like this claim that Christianity is for adult minds. I believe with a passion that grown-ups deserve what we offer in this room, at least 1 hour in the week when we can be together to worship quietly and without distraction, to deepen down in mind and spirit, so that when we go back to our children, we go with something that will help to lift them up to the next level. I'm not sure America hasn't lost sight of it, but the plan for children is to help them grow up, not to keep them as long as possible in a state of suspended childhood, but to lead them, even to push them, if necessary, toward the thoughtful independence of mature life. Children, after all, actually look forward to growing up. With a few good role models, they sense that it's a beautiful thing to be mature, to have left behind the crushing egotisms of childhood, the vast ignorance, the arrogant certainties, the smooth, untouched faces that have never sorrowed deeply for someone else. Most people, like Paul, are glad to have moved on from those features of childhood. Partly, I suppose, because one of the marks of childishness is what I have called in the title of this sermon, the guest complex. It's that queer notion held tenaciously by all who refuse to grow up, that we are in this world to be waited upon, that we hold a divine right to the best linen, the finest bed, the most exquisite food. Such people never become hosts. Putting themselves out for others, taking the second best bed gladly, eating less because there is not enough for everybody, they are instead eternal guests, the center of the universe, God's favorite children. They remind me of the world of that little boy who said to a friend one day, "I'm really worried. Dad slaves away at his job, so I'll have a bike and then a car, and be able to go to college. Mom works hard, washing and ironing, cleaning up after me, taking care of me when I get sick. They spend every day of their lives just working on my behalf. I'm worried." His friend looked at him with amazement. "What have you got to worry about?" He said, "I'm worried that they might try to escape." Some of us have, I suppose. If you like astronomy, you might call it the pre-Copernicus way of looking at the world. Stars and suns and planets all revolving around us. It's cute at 4, still bearable at 14, but hideous at 44. Most of us have two circles in our minds, one marked me, the other marked the not me. And we've worked out ways to keep them in balance. But in the childish mind, there is only one circle. The not me doesn't exist. Historian Arnold Toynbee has a wonderful phrase for the childish mind. He calls it momentary momentousness. Everything going on is of colossal importance. There is no distinction between the vital and the trivial. If it's happening now and it's happening to me, in the childish mind, it's all important. I don't know whether he was really this bad or not, but someone tried to describe the immaturity of George Moore, a 19th century English novelist, by saying that he always managed to get himself in the forefront of any conversation, and even his own novels, that his life was, quote, a succession of pictures. Houses of Parliament with George Moore on the steps. The Colosseum at Rome with a distant view of George Moore. Ruins of George Moore by moonlight. The opposite of that consuming ego is being grown up, a condition the Apostle Paul links directly with agape love. The ability to get beyond ourselves, to understand, even if we cannot approve, another point of view, another way of life. The ability to feel joy in our own existence, to be convinced of our own value without having to shout it from the rooftops to everybody. And do I need this morning to remind you that people who do not value themselves may do enormous harm? You saw it in the images from Los Angeles. Not so much hatred for the other, although it appears so at first glance, but hatred for oneself. Some black people risked being insulted or hurt by warning whites to stay out of the neighborhood. Others, who never had or who had lost any sense of self-worth, jumped at the chance to vent their frustration and anger on the closest thing at hand. I happen to be, and nobody worries in this church about agreeing with me, but I happen to be on the side of those who think the jury verdict was wrong. I hope it is reversed by federal intervention, but I was horrified at the rage directed at innocent people. You may drag someone from a car and beat him half to death. You may dance in glee while running from stores with T-bone steaks and tennis shoes. You may laugh while a Korean woman weeps as her life's work goes up in smoke, but you do not do such things if you are proud of who you are. And when the moment of hideous opportunity is past and you creep back into the anonymity of dark streets, the self-hatred comes back and consumes your life. We're not much in the mood to reach out, I suppose, to wonder how we can change things once the curfew is lifted and the guard goes home. But we find a way to change them. Or next time will be worse, just as this was worse than Watts. There's a beautiful speech in the play called Raisin in the Sun. When a black woman says to her daughter-in-law, "When do you think is the time to love somebody the most. When they done good and made things easy for everybody? Well, that ain't the time at all. It's when he's at his lowest and can't believe in himself because the world done whipped him. I have to say that I was deeply moved to see white people go into the ghetto to work side by side with blacks to clean up that mess in South Central LA. Not all the whites. Some were too full of hatred. Any one of us might have been. But ones in whom understanding was even more persistent than outrage. And I was enormously proud of the church when the groceries were brought to people who no longer had a store nearby. That's what churches do. People make fun of churches sometimes. The college kids whom I taught for so many years of my life love to make fun of churches. But in desperate times, churches do good things. Some of the thugs and thieves may be irreclaimable. I'm a realist. But some are ashamed when the people they have victimized and hated come to help, and they may be saved. But only the truly grown up, motivated by this thing we've named 100 times in the sermons of spring, agape love, can reach out to others when every instinct is to recoil. It takes a lot of confidence in oneself. One of my favorite movies was called 1,000 Clowns. It was about a nonconformist named Murray Burns, who forever heckles his seemingly placid brother, Arnold. All through the movie, we are fascinated by the antics of the nonconformist. Jason Robards played the part, I think, I remember. We like him. We identify with him. But all of a sudden, in one of those revelations that make great art, the plodding, typical conformist brother Arnold makes his response to the constant needling. He says, "Murray, I've long been aware that you don't respect me much. In fact, I am willing to deal with the available world. I'm not an exceptional man. So it is possible for me to stay with things the way they are. I'm lucky in an odd way. I'm gifted. I have a talent for surrender. I'm at peace. But you are cursed, and I like you. So it makes me sad you don't have the gift. And I see the torture of it. All I can do is worry for you, but I will not worry for myself. You cannot convince me that I am one of the bad guys. I get up. I go. I lie a little. I peddle a little. I watch the rules. I talk the talk. But I will not apologize for it. I take pride. I am the best possible Arnold Burns." Well, I still remember, after many years, how that speech jolted me suddenly in that movie. I did not want to be like Arnold. I don't want to surrender yet. I don't want to conform as much as he did. I don't want to accept a life as circumscribed and molded by convention. But what amazed me was the incredible honesty of that speech. Arnold had come to know himself. In his own quiet, unassuming way, he had figured out who he was. You haven't particularly liked him up to that point. But when he pours out that self-description and admits, I am the best possible Arnold Burns, you realize there is more maturity than you had guessed. No longer just a guest in the world, but one of the patient hosts, accommodating to his own weakness and the weaknesses of others, he can live with the rest of us and live at peace. He's not bright. He's not witty. But having learned to love himself with some degree of wisdom and insight, he can love others. And I would say to you that in our own attempts to grow up and still keep the lovable qualities of children, we could do worse.